from London, BBC Caribbean Report.
Battle lines drawn in Anguilla and candidates declared in Dominica as election fever grips these two islands. Lessons on how the Caribbean can become influential in Washington and why travel agents should engage in belt tightening.
The challenge is to find new creative ways to provide additional services.
I'm Ken Richards and this is BBC Caribbean Report.
I'm saying to the people, you have a choice. Choose the sheep or the goats. And if you chose the goats, I'd be quite happy to live with that because at least I have done my duty.
Anguilla's Chief Minister Hubert Hughes, who alleges that Britain is trying to get him out of office. It's an allegation not shared in opposition circles.
None at all. None at all. Mr. Hughes's downfall is his own making. And the world knows this.
Opposition leader Osborne Fleming, more from him in a moment. The chief minister, forced on Wednesday into calling a general election 4 years ahead of schedule, says his Anguilla United Party will contest all 7 seats in the March 10 elections. His coalition administration with Victor Banks' Anguilla Democratic Party began to fall apart last May when Mr. Banks resigned as finance minister because of difficulty with the chief minister's leadership style. Chief Minister Hughes says through the elections he'll challenge what he calls the agenda of Britain's Foreign and Commonwealth Office, but his AUP has to contend with cooperation between the Anguilla National Alliance of Opposition Leader Fleming and Victor Banks's ADP. Mr. Fleming told me it's clear that recommendations for fresh elections by Britain's Minister for Overseas Territories, Baroness Patricia Scotland, forced Chief Minister Hughes to return to the polls.
It was just recently he told the people that he would leave office at gunpoint. And it was surprising that all of a sudden he dissolved the House without a gun being pointed at his head.
Why couldn't this crisis have been resolved much earlier?
All because of the arrogance of Mr. Hughes.
How exactly will the opposition alliance between yourself and Mr. Banks work in terms of the campaign and the elections themselves?
We will be campaigning as a united front. We are, at present, a united front in the opposition. One of the reasons why we have gone this way is because for years after the elections in Anguilla and the No Party had the majority, there was always turmoil and confusion to form a government.
But how many candidates will your party field and how many will Mr. Banks's party?
At present, my party will field no less than 5 candidates. And it seems to me that Mr. Banks will field no less than 2. That's how it looks right now.
So you won't contest against each other?
Of course not. We had a job to do. We were fighting the common enemy. It would be stupid for us to go on the platforms now and oppose and curse and castigate each other. We're not doing that.
But if there's an opposition victory in the March 10th election, there'll likely be another coalition. Aren't you worried because of the past history of coalition governments in Anguilla?
Not at all. The opposition coalition will be made up of men of caliber and decency and honesty.
Anguilla's opposition leader, Osborne Fleming. Dominica's 3 recognized political parties are fielding 55 candidates in the January 31st general election. They confirmed this with electoral officials today, Nominations Day. Now that the candidates are officially declared, the political campaign atmosphere is expected to intensify even more as the parties and their supporters move into high gear for the coming poll. It's less than 3 weeks away. Curtis Matthew reports.
Both the governing United Workers' Party and the opposition Dominica Labour Party were confirming 21 candidates for the upcoming elections, while the Dominica Freedom Party says 13 candidates were nominated today. This week, the race to the elections took a new twist with the discussions between the opposition parties. They say they have been discussing how the parties can work together to defeat the UWP government. However, candidates on both sides have said they would not be part of any arrangement, which would mean their withdrawal from the race. The Kolliho seat on the West Coast is one example where the opposition parties have strong following, but both candidates were nominated today. The Dominica Freedom Party says it was deliberately not contesting certain seats to ensure the Dominica Labour Party has the advantage. A poll conducted here this week puts the governing party ahead with 39.5% of the votes, with the Dominica Labour Party 34.7% and the Dominica Freedom Party 9%. There are 3,913 new voters, with 60,165 voters to go to the polls. Political observer Gordon Morrow says the governing party can be comfortable with the slender margin. The Dominica Labour Party says, despite the results of the poll, they are in the lead, while the Dominica Freedom Party is expecting stronger following as the campaign progresses. Despite claims by the governing party that they will take more new seats at the polls to add to their 12, political observers believe that the Wesley, Carib Territory, Vickers, and St. Joseph seats held by the governing party are too close to call. The campaign heats up this weekend with all three parties holding mass meetings. The campaign has been violent-free so far, although police said this morning a few tires were slashed at the governing party's meeting in the north last night. Curtis Matthew in Roseau for BBC Caribbean Report.
Talks on hammering out a new trade and aid agreement are to continue in Brussels early next month between the European Union and the African, Caribbean and Pacific group of countries. The major unresolved issue will be that of good governance, a clause the EU insisted on writing into the agreement. Orin Gordon has this report.
The EU's chief negotiator, Philip Lowe, says the last negotiating session in December came close to finalizing an agreement and only a few subjects remain. The controversial clauses on good governance is one of them. The EU feels that African countries especially have badly misspent aid money from them and others, with much of it ending up in the accounts of government ministers and their cronies. The thinking behind good governance is that they'd be more inclined to give aid to countries that have governments which are likely to spend the money well. Caribbean countries have sided with the African countries in the ACP in opposing the good governance proposal, arguing it was for the people of the country to change their governments if they were not up to standard. What they're wary of is having too many European strings attached to aid they're really in need of. Philip Lowe insists that the ACP and Europe are closer together in their thinking than is apparent. We have to fight against corruption as a major target, he said, and he's optimistic that it will be part of a new agreement. What'll perhaps be more difficult to explain is how this old-fashioned trade and aid agreement will stand up in a climate in which global free trade is becoming the trend. The EU has recognized this with its earlier insistence that ACP countries join regional trade bodies to establish free trade zones, but it has since dropped the insistence. Negotiations have been a tricky business. That looks set to continue in Brussels.
Orin Gordon. A former director of U.S. Affairs on Latin America and the Caribbean is advising closer economic and political integration within CARICOM. Former advisor to the Carter administration, Robert Pastor, says this as one means of getting a better deal with the United States. Dr. Pastor is in Grenada reflecting on U.S.-Caribbean relations and what the future holds. He told an audience at St. George's University that over the last 100 years, U.S. policy in the Caribbean has fluctuated between disinterest and fears that a foreign power can gain a toehold in the Caribbean basin. Tony Fraser was in the audience listening.
In the present, he says, the American political focus is on domestic matters. He says even if a few international issues are raised during the presidential campaign, it's quite unlikely that the Caribbean will be featured. Therefore, Dr. Pastor said, CARICOM has to develop its own initiative to impact on the U.S. Internal economic reforms and an export base are the first steps, he says. He says political integration among the 9 OECS countries, a single currency in CARICOM, and greater trade liberalization among CARICOM states would also set the stage and make the U.S. sit up and take notice.
Caribbean leaders from time to time ask me, well, can't we replicate what the Jewish community has done or what the Cuban-American community has done, whether we agree with their objectives, they are very effective. A part of the Jewish community is to preserve and to save Israel and to defend Israel. A part of the Cuban-American community, it's to stick it to Fidel Castro. And they're both very effective at translating this very clear objective. I think if the Caribbean were to define a bold and clear program and go to its natural constituency, its own people, as well as its friends, I believe that it stands a very good chance of influencing the United States.
But Dr. Pastor is realistic enough to say that even so, the approach is a long shot. But he says America is an open and diverse society and can be influenced by such matters. Tony Fraser reporting from St. George's University campus in Grenada for BBC Caribbean Report.
In Port of Spain tomorrow, Caribbean travel agents are to decide on a response to American Airlines' decision to cut their commissions by a third. They've reacted angrily, threatening to stop issuing tickets on behalf of AA. One proposal they'll consider is promoting Biwi and Air Jamaica on the Puerto Rico-US route so that the island can continue to act as a hub for passengers from the US. The president of the Jamaica Hotel and Tourism Association, James Samuels, thinks it will be a pointless exercise.
Costs to airlines in general have been increasing steadily over the years, and the recent international increase in fuel prices, for instance, is going to make quite a bit of an impact. More than a year ago, in fact, they have determined that they were going to reduce travel agency commissions as part of their overall cost compression initiative. It's now reached the Caribbean.
There's nothing really the travel agents can do to reverse the cut, is there?
No, I don't think so. The challenge is to find new creative ways to provide additional services that you could charge. To make a travel agent to your office at no cost. Now, these are services that if you want, you should be paying for.
Do you think they'll be successful in getting Biwi and Air Jamaica to pick up Americans' business between the U.S. and Puerto Rico?
I don't think that's going to make a great deal of difference because already Air Jamaica has indicated that they're going to follow suit with the American Airlines reduction. So while American Airlines will seem like the big bad wolf in this, the fact of the matter, it was coming down the pike, and all airlines are going to be falling in line with that, I think.
Does the reduced commission compare unfavorably with what U.S. travel agents get, or is it the same?
It's about the same for the U.S. In fact, I mean, when they did it in the U.S. last year, I mean, there was tremendous fallout there. Travel agents are actually more luckier in Europe. You get a better situation in Europe, I think, by one point.
So what's your advice to angry travel agents meeting in Port of Spain this weekend to discuss this reduced commission issue?
They've got to really and truly look at themselves and say, what are the services that we can provide? Or in fact, first of all, what are we providing now that, frankly, people are paying for in other communities? What are the new services that we can provide? Because the truth of the matter is that there is a changing role for the travel agent. And the travel agent now has to look very, very seriously at new ideas, new ways in which they can provide services to their consumers.
James Samuels. Miami's Haitian community has hailed a decision by the U.S. Attorney General to grant two Haitian children a humanitarian parole. This allows the two to leave Haiti to reside in the United States with their mother for 3 months while her political asylum claim is decided. The children survived a four-day ocean crossing from Haiti to Miami on board a dangerously overloaded fishing boat with 400 other illegal immigrants, only to be repatriated to Haiti without their mother. Leslie Goff reports.
Miami's Haitian community is celebrating the news that 8-year-old Germany and 9-year-old Mark Ronville will be reunited with their mother in days, instead of years, as the U.S. Immigration Service had previously suggested. Their mother, Ivina, is 4 months pregnant and was allowed into the United States for medical treatment. Ms. Ronville's attorney, Cheryl Little, director of the Florida Immigration Advocacy Center, said her client was thrilled she would soon be seeing her children.
She's ecstatic. I got the official word from Washington yesterday afternoon. The Haitian community sent a powerful message to Washington. Lots of media in town covering the Elian Gonzalez case. So, you know, the Haitian community was able to take advantage of that and get their story out.
But U.S. immigration official Mike Gilhooley insists the Elian Gonzalez case and demonstrations by Haitians in Miami this week had little to do with the decision to reunite the Ronville family.
There's no relation between the case of Ms. Renville and her two children and any other immigration case at all. When migrants are interdicted at sea, and they're evacuated due to a medical emergency, children or other immediate family members are evacuated with the principal without hesitation.
The U.S. Immigration Service says the two Ronville children will need Haitian passports, which should take about 2 or 3 days to issue, after which they'll be flown to South Florida to live with their mother while her claim for political asylum is decided. For BBC Caribbean Report, this is Leslie Goff in New York.
The United States government has expressed its surprise over a decision by Venezuela not to allow further troops into their country. Two ships laden with equipment and engineers were heading towards the South American country to help with the recovery program following last month's devastating floods, but they're now very unlikely to reach Venezuelan waters. That's Caribbean Report. I'm Ken Richards, saying goodbye from London.